Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It doesn't matter whether your vote's going to John McCain or to Barack Obama. It doesn't matter whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, because chances are really good the economic agenda of the next president of the United States was set today. The White House announced that next year we are going to see the biggest budget deficit ever. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, gang, the 28th of July. Great to have you with us. The two presidential candidates can talk tax policy and healthcare initiatives until they're blue in the face, but their best-laid plans ran into an enormous obstacle today. The nearly $500 billion in red ink that's going to hit them the first time they sit down to do a budget. And that's before you even start adding in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has a closer look.
The White House's deficit forecast comes in at about $482 billion. That's around the size of the gross domestic product of Belgium. What's behind the sky-high deficit? White House Budget Director Jim Nussle says it's
because of the bipartisan growth package or stimulus checks, as well as slower economic growth.
President Bush's tax cuts and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan also added to the deficit, and the White House doesn't count additional tens of billions in war costs. Economist Gus Fauché of Moody'sEconomy.com says that's a mistake.
If we think that those costs are going to be ongoing, then we really should say, look, how are we going to fund these, rather than just borrowing and saying we'll pay it back in the future.
The projected deficit is a record in terms of dollars, but the White House says it's only about 3% of our gross domestic product, less than in the 1980s. Still, economist William Hummer says that's a poor excuse.
I agree with those who think it's too easy a way out. Spending is excessive.
Merrill Lynch says the government might have to sell $1 trillion in debt next year to keep up that spending. Robert Bixby of the deficit watchdog Concord Coalition calls that daunting.
People look at the United States and they say they're fighting a war and they've got health care and retirement costs coming up and they just don't seem to be doing anything to get their fiscal house in order. Why should we lend them money?
Bixby says those who do open their wallets may demand higher interest rates. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
You heard Budget Director Jim Nussle say it right up at the top of Nancy's piece. Slower economic growth and so lower tax revenues help drive the budget deficit higher. As that economy slows, in part because it slows, so is our driving. And here's a great thought experiment to put that into perspective for you. Imagine driving from the Earth to the moon and then repeat, about 40,000 times. That's about the number of miles American drivers cut back during the month of May. The out-of-this-world price of gas is keeping more cars in the garage, and the Department of Transportation said today the May decline is a record, and it's taking a big bite out of taxes that are used to support highway funding. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports.
Last fall, Nick Segan's Ford Escort broke down, so he started taking the bus to work in Detroit. With gas prices so high, Segan opted not to replace the car. Without the car and insurance payments and the gas, Segan says he's saving about $300 a month.
It actually ended up saving enough to pay for the majority of our trip to Disney World.
Between last November and May of this year, people like Segan drove more than 40 billion fewer miles on U.S. highways compared to the year before. The Transportation Department says that's the steepest six-month decline in the 66 years it's been keeping records. And it raises serious questions about highway funding. As people buy less fuel, that means less tax revenue to pay for road repairs and construction. The Federal Highway Trust Fund is facing facing a multi-billion-dollar budget gap next year. Pat Choate directs the Manufacturing Policy Project. He says the solution is simple. Congress should raise the federal gas tax from just over 18 cents a gallon to 27 cents and then adjust for inflation in the future.
At $4 gasoline, that doesn't really mean much, particularly with the swings that we've had in prices in the past several years. If they'll take that one action, it'll solve the problem.
Raising the gas tax would be a political challenge, to say the least. But drivers may end up paying more regardless. The Transportation Department has been pushing for more toll roads. Choate says on one stretch of highway in Virginia, the tolls could end up costing commuters more than gasoline. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Oil today, by the way, rose a bit more than a dollar to about $124 a barrel. The nationwide average for gas dipped below $4 for the first time in 2 months. Part of the economic slowdown is being driven by the fact that consumers aren't spending as much because everything is getting more expensive, not just oil and gas. The same thing is happening to some companies where rising commodity prices are eating into profits. Tyson Foods, the country's biggest meat company, said today earnings dropped more than 90% last quarter because of grain costs for all that livestock. But I guess it depends on who you're feeding, because Marketplace's Steve Henn reports Kraft profits are fattening right up.
Despite a tough economy, the maker of Oreos and Velveeta raised its prices last quarter and boosted its earnings. Matt Arnold follows the firm for Edward D. Jones.
Kraft has iconic products, and the fact that they do so well at making products that people just adore is certainly going to help them in this environment.
Take my crippling addiction to Oreos.
Who's that kid with the Oreo cookies?
There's no way I'm going to give them up when Kraft pushes through a price increase. And Matt Arnold says if you're in the mood for a little home-cooked comfort food, but you don't actually want to cook, Kraft has you covered, even in a recession.
If you think about the consumer, one of the first things, if they want to tighten their budget up a little bit, eat less at restaurants and eat more food at home. So Kraft's product offering plays quite well to that.
Don't have $25 for a pizza delivery to your door?
For fresh baked pizza today, it's not delivery, it's DiGiorno.
Coffee at Starbucks starting to seem like an extravagance? Kraft is there with Maxwell House. Robert Moskow at Credit Suisse says by positioning itself as an affordable alternative, Kraft is growing its waistline in a shrinking economy.
People are paying more at the gas tank. They're paying more at the grocery store. If you can market brands and be a hero to the consumer by offering low-priced, high-value food, you're going to gain market share.
Moskow says the question for Kraft is, how long will it be able to raise prices on its beloved brands before Americans bolt for even cheaper alternatives? In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Wall Street never really had a chance today. Financial stocks gave the major indices a firm push lower. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. They probably missed the irony entirely, but the International Monetary Fund released its Global Financial Stability Report today. Among other things, the report says the bottom of the housing market is nowhere in sight, but that kind of depends on where you look, because one of every 171 houses in this country is in some stage of foreclosure. Banks don't want to own them. They want to get rid of them, so they're unloading them cheap and driving down prices. And in some areas, that has brought back bargain hunters and memories of the housing market before the bust. From Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
It was yet another abandoned house in the working-class neighborhood of Little Havana. A big patio, a shed out back, and a colony of bees in the rafters. When realtor Chris Vane first visited, the grass was 3 feet high.
These bushes here in front, you couldn't even see inside the house. This tree did not have a single leaf on it. It was dead.
The bank wanted to unload the three-bedroom house in 30 days. It was appraised at $350,000. The bank's asking price? $190,000. Realtor Christina Lopez works with Vane.
I was getting 10 to 15 calls a day from realtors, as well as just people looking and passing by in a car or just even walking in a neighborhood.
One of those calls came from 22-year-old Sonia Aguilar. She and six family members were squeezed into two one-bedroom apartments. For months, she'd been eyeing that house. She had financing in place. She was just waiting for the price to drop.
You know when you look at something and you're like, I want it? You want it.
Sonia put in an offer. So did six others, including a woman Sonia met at an open house.
I'm like, oh God, I hope they don't have more money than me.
Did you look her up and down?
No. Well, yeah. Yeah, I had to. You know, I was trying to see what kind of people they were, you know.
In markets around the country, prices are plummeting. Buyers are beginning to worry that if they wait too long, they could miss the best deals.
Hello. Amado. Hi, how are you? Did you find anything new?
Realtor Lisa Thompson specializes in foreclosed properties for Coldwell Banker in Pinecrest, a Tony suburb of Miami. She says if the price is right, a home can sell within hours.
The other day we had a foreclosure property that we had on the market that was about 40% under appraised value, and it was on the market for one day, and we had about eight contracts come in on the property, and it sold $35,000 over asking price.
Multiple offers and bidding wars remain the exception, but the deadlock between buyers and sellers has been broken by banks. Foreclosure sales often reset home values in an entire neighborhood. Thompson says that forces stubborn sellers to be realistic.
What we do is we kind of flashcard. Then we say, look, at the price that you want, this is what you can get. Would you buy your house or would you buy this house with marble floors, has an additional 1,000 square feet, and it has a pool? That makes them realize actually what their house is worth.
Sellers will be looking at a lot more flashcards. Data company RealtyTrack projects more than 2 million foreclosures in 2008. That could produce more small buying frenzies as bargain hunters move in.
I was just speaking with an investor out of California yesterday, and he says that banks are just dumping properties. I mean, it's literally all over the country.
That doesn't mean banks are giving houses away, and tight credit will keep many buyers on the sidelines. In South Florida, 33,000 homes were up for sale in May. Fewer than 900 changed hands. One that did sell was the house in Little Havana. Realtor Christina Lopez says the winning bid was the asking price.
I called her, and I said, Sonia, are you sitting down? And she said, yes. I said, guess what? Your offer was accepted. She screamed. She goes, my prayers have been answered.
The Aguilar family is fixing up their new home. Sonia's husband is refinishing the walls. Outside, her father is trimming the bushes with a machete, as is the custom in his native Honduras. This abandoned house is coming back to life. Even that dying royal Ponciana out front is in bloom. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Whether you're stuck at the office or fighting traffic on the way home, there are plenty of places you'd probably rather be right now. If one of them's heading to the beach with a good paperback and a couple hours to kill, you have come to just the right place. As part of our annual Marketplace Beach Reads series, once again this year we've asked some of our commentators for their nominations. Economist Susan Lee leads off today with a hero from before the Great Depression, but one whose story is going to sound familiar to anybody who's been following today's housing market.
He made nothing in particular. Neither butter, nor shoes, nor poetry. But he was nimble in the calling of selling houses for more than people could afford to pay. That's 46-year-old George F. Babbitt in 1920. He's the endearingly boorish title character of Sinclair Lewis's novel set in the Midwestern city of Zenith. Almost 90 years have come and gone, but Babbitt's world is stunningly familiar. For starters, he's an aggressive real estate broker of the kind recently encountered in the housing bubble. Babbitt is slightly crooked, not above a bit of self-dealing with a nod from his bank. A lot about life in Zenith is recognizable. Dinner parties are for social climbing, church going is for networking. But there are also lots of things about Zenith that seem totally alien, and they make reading Babbitt kind of like taking a cultural vacation. It's almost exotic to read about a time in America when premarital sex was taboo, when women were always ladies, and, like Mrs. Babbitt, stayed home, worrying about how many salted almonds to place before each dinner plate, where your suburban neighbors drank like fish and smoked like chimneys, and where it was a mark of achievement to belong to the Brotherly and Protective Order of Elks, a lodge where men greet each other by yelling, "How's the old Bolsheviki?" Lewis wrote Babbitt as a searing social commentary. He wanted to skewer the Midwestern middle class, just as Edith Wharton eviscerated the East Coast aristocracy. And yes, Babbitt is an effective satire about the conformity and boobishness of the businessmen of Zenith. Lewis's characters wallow in a type of boosterism which extends far beyond local commerce, a boosterism that drives everything from culture and politics to innermost thoughts of self and family. No doubt, Babbitt's world is smug and insular, but that's what makes it such a perfect beach read. It's possible to become as absorbed in Babbitt's world as Babbitt himself was.
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. We've also been asking you to send along some of your recommendations. Muhammad Asadullah from Atlanta, Georgia, offered up Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen about Mortensen's efforts to build schools in some remote parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan. If you've got another one for us, go to marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says Best Marketplace Beach Reads. Coming up, an argument in favor of pranks in the workplace.
You can't be 100% effective and efficient in any job. I mean, there's definitely socializing, there's the water cooler, there's email, but this is with a smile.
But first, let's do the numbers. After spending most of last week rationalizing that it could have been worse, investors went back to worrying today that things maybe really are as bad as they seem. The Dow Industrials skidded 239 points, more than 2%, ending at 11,131. The Nasdaq gave up 46 points and even 2% to finish at 2,264. The S&P 500 dropped 23 points, 1.8%. Wrapped up the trading day at 12:34. Nagging concerns over the credit and housing markets hit financial stocks and hit them hard. Merrill Lynch was the lightning rod. Its shares got zapped 11.5% today. Lehman Brothers lost 10.5%. And when it comes to Fannie Mae, investors were saying, maybe not. Its shares dropped 10.75% today, while struggling cousin Freddie Mac lost 6.75%. Or investors went looking for a safe haven in bonds today. Prices rose. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note down to an even 4%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. President Bush is scheduled to be in Cleveland to tour Lincoln Electric, a welding company. He'll speak on energy and the economy. And a House committee holds a hearing to examine credit scoring and what borrowers need to know about it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's not just consumers who aren't driving as much now that gas is so expensive. Companies have cut back as well, a fact that is changing how they do business and, in some cases, how we eat. The buzzword you've probably heard already, locavores, people who try to eat locally grown food. It's usually fresher and better for the environment since it's not being trucked across the country. Companies like Whole Foods, Walmart, and Chipotle have embraced it. And as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports, they're finding a nice side benefit as diesel pushes $5 a gallon.
It's a hot, sunny day in the fields at Homestead Farms in southern New Jersey. Farm workers walk along the rows, picking green peppers and tossing them into baskets. A tractor collects the full baskets and takes them to the processing area, where the vegetables are dumped on a conveyor belt. Washed, then sorted by size and boxed. Then they're put on a truck and driven to Manhattan. They'll end up at Chipotle, the Mexican fast food chain, where they'll be chopped up and added to burritos and tacos. Peppers aren't the only things Chipotle buys from New Jersey farms. Jim Donio is one of the farmers.
We produce green peppers, some jalapeno peppers as well, and then we source romaine lettuce along with tomatoes and some other products as well, cilantro.
It's about 100 miles from Donio's farm to New York. Not exactly next door, maybe, but certainly a lot closer than it could be.
Generally, most of the produce for the country, for the U.S., comes from California.
Ann Daniels is in charge of purchasing for Chipotle.
Obviously, when we're able to approve a local farmer in New Jersey, then that's cutting out significant miles.
Companies like Chipotle and Walmart aren't buying produce locally just to save on gas money. They say it's a way to get fresher food, help local farmers, and it's good for the environment. But they're finding the fuel savings are an added bonus. Transportation makes up about 20% of the energy used for food, and it costs about 4 cents of every dollar spent on food to get it from one place to another. Jim Donio explains.
If Chipotle was buying romaine lettuce from California to service and source stores that are located in New Jersey and Philadelphia and in the Northeast, that's 3,000 miles worth of fuel for that case of romaine lettuce. I mean, the economic impact is it could add $2 to $4 per case to the cost of the romaine.
If Chipotle buys romaine from local farmers during the summer's 10-week growing season, Donio calculates it could save as much as $100,000 on transportation. Chipotle's Ann Daniel says the company's trying to find sources within 200 miles of the final destination. But it's hard, even in the Garden State.
We started with some farmers that were significantly smaller, and some of them were simply too small to have the food safety measures and the traceability measures.
Climate and growing seasons are problems, too. You just can't grow avocados in New Jersey, for example. So Chipotle is starting small. For now, each restaurant will get a quarter of at least one produce item from local sources.
You're talking about a very small part of their supply chain in terms of the food and logistics.
Greg Keolian directs the Center for Sustainable Systems at the University of Michigan.
I think it is something that we need to move more towards in terms of enhancing sustainability, and that is, you know, really looking at more regional solutions to our meeting our needs. And so I think this is an important step towards that.
An important step towards sustainability, though maybe not towards savings. Buying locally may save on fuel, but smaller farms can't offer economies of scale, so their produce costs more, and that may eat up any savings on gas. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
I don't know if this is an anniversary too many office workers out there would care to celebrate, but the cubicle turns 40 years old this month. And for those who've had an exceptionally difficult Monday back at the office today, we've got something that might help the next time you've got the cubicle blues. John Austin's new book about lightening things up at the office with some good old-fashioned pranks is called Cubicle Warfare. John, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Hey, listen, do you actually work in an office?
I do part-time, yes.
So, in other words, people could conceivably hate you for doing all these pranks, right?
Well, definitely. It all depends if you consider them malicious or humorous.
Well, that's a good point. How do you know who's going to take it which way?
Well, I think you have to use your best judgment. How well you know your associates, and what level do you know them, who you choose, you know, who's your mark, who's your victim, and then the type of prank that you would pull on that individual.
Maybe I ought to back up and ask you why we need office pranks to begin with.
The office can get a little boring once in a while. You get in your day in and day out routines. And this is just to bring some humor to the workplace.
Give me a couple of examples here of your favorites. I mean, the book's got 101 of them, so pick a couple for me.
Okay, one of them in the book is called Dark Coffee BBs. It's kind of the Martha Stewart of the office pranks. You need two paper cups. You create a false bottom on one of them. You fill them up with those little copper BBs that your child may use in his BB gun. And then you fill the top of it up with coffee. And then you place this cup in front of your Mark's keyboard. He comes back from lunch, sets down his car keys. He removes that, you know, that strange cup of coffee that's located in front of his keyboard. and 500 BBs cascade out of the bottom of it. I love that one.
All right. Now, I have to tell you, if somebody did that to me, I don't know. I don't know that I'm going to take it so well.
Oh, no. We pulled that off a couple times, and you can definitely hear some cursing in the cubicle next to you. So it's one of those pranks that you laugh about it after it happens, not while it's happening.
We did one around here the other day, and we went to one of our office mates' cubicles here, and his name's Kevin Arnovitz. He's one of our editors. And we did the Christmas wrapping thing, where you wrap pretty much the whole cube in Christmas paper.
It's going to be the dorkiest prank.
Should I wrap his headphones in paper towels?
Oh, that's a great idea.
We also sort of double-dipped him. We did the Vaseline on the telephone earpiece thing,
yes,
too.
Yes, I love that one.
All right, he's coming down the hall.
It's Kevin. Kai, I'm doing fine. The nice selection of gifts here. No, thank you. Thank you for the Vaseline. I haven't felt this since I got a wet willy from my Camcast. So 13.
And he took it pretty well, but really, had he been a less collegial guy, it you know, these things have ripple effects. It could have gotten sort of ugly.
Definitely. And if he also feels that it's, you know, a bunch of his associates are teaming up on him, he could feel like he's backed up into the corner. You know, if he retaliates against one of you, then there's four or five other people that could retaliate against him again.
I'm going to get all technical on you here and throw in a word that economists like to use, lost productivity. I mean, well, if you're cleaning up 500 BBs, you're not cranking out widgets for the man.
That's very true, very true. But then again, you can't be 100% effective and efficient in any job. I mean, there's definitely socializing, there's the water cooler, there's email. But this is with a smile, so you got to appreciate that.
Do you think, to some extent, bosses ought to encourage this sort of lightheartedness?
Well, you know, bosses do encourage team building, you know, off-sites, collaboration. It's like mixing it up in the office. So I think that when you keep it on a humorous, you know, non-malicious level, I think, yeah, they should definitely encourage it.
Next time you wake up with Vaseline in your telephone earpiece, blame John Austin. His book is called Cubicle Warfare, 101 Office Traps and Pranks. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
We, of course, took pictures when we gift-wrapped Kevin Arnovitz's cubicle. They're online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of the rich get richer and the rest of us don't. In Hamburg, Germany today, Emirates Airlines took delivery of its first Airbus A380. That's the much-delayed double-decker that's just beginning now to come online. The version Emirates picked up today will carry perhaps 500 people, but the relative few who can afford to sit in the front of the plane will be able to do something special to freshen up after a long flight. Two first-class bathrooms are going to have showers in them. 5-minute maximum, though, since the plane can only carry so much water, you know. Emirates said to make up for the extra weight of all that water, it's going to take all the magazines out of the seat back pockets. So no SkyMall for you if you're stuck for something to read, I guess. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 239 points, 2.1%. The Nasdaq fell 46 points, 2%. The S&P 500 dipped 23 points, 1.8%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, weighing costs against cuisine.
Oh, I don't know if there's a price I'd walk away from salmon. Salmon is so good. I suppose $20 a pound, I'd really have to look at something else to eat.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all
all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.